The reform movement in the North, which Sumner joined, was abortive. First, it split the combination of industry and abolition democracy, which had won the Civil War and reconstructed the South, and it threatened to put the Copperhead Democratic Party back in power. This latter party had not only supported the South against the East in the Civil War, but had fought the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, and now was seeking to unite with the radical West. The abolition democracy itself was largely based on property, believed in capital, and formed, in effect, a powerful petty bourgeoisie. It believed in democratic government, but only under a general dictatorship of property. Most of the leaders of the revolt of 1872 in the North lived on investments or received salaries from investments. They did not believe in a democratic movement which could confiscate and redistribute property, except possibly in an extreme case like slavery. But even here, while they seized stolen property in human bodies, they never could bring themselves to countenance the redistribution of property in land and tools, which rested, in fact, on no less defensible bases. Not only, then, did the property complaint of the South fall on their sensitive and responsive ears, they were the more aroused at familiar complaints of theft and corruption in public office because this was precisely the thing that they were fighting in the North. They found themselves in dilemma. They could not join the ex-slave Democratic Party and repudiate their own investments in government bonds and industry. They could not maintain further political alliance with the industrial and political order eventually responsible for the Crédit Mobilier, the Whiskey Ring, and the Gold Corner. Their logical path lay toward organized labor, leading to a combination of Eastern intellectuals, Western peasant farmers, and the Great Army of Labor. But the Panic of 1873 altered the face of society. The era of business depression which followed helped this consolidation of industrial control in a few hands. The Panic of 1873 changed, too, the history of the South. Already in 1870, the Republicans had lost their two-thirds majority in Congress, and in 1874, for the first time in 20 years, the Democrats had a majority in the House of Representatives. They looked forward confidently to controlling the nation in 1876. Even in the face of catastrophe, the North had moral courage and the spirit of faith among large numbers of its best citizens. The history of abolition is full proof of this. But sacrifice must build on faith. A saving nucleus of the North believed in the Negro from experience and study, but this same class had lost faith in democratic methods in the North. The experience with the Irish in Massachusetts and New York, misgovernment, crime, and dirt in the great industrial cities were attributed to the laboring masses. How could they rightly exercise the power to rule? New England lost faith in democracy and cherished something like a race hatred for the Irish. Her Puritan past kept her just. She gave them schools. She refused discriminatory laws in religion. But she doubted. And even if she knew the end was mass rule, it was a long, long, bitter way. And a crisis was already here. The system of capital and private profit smashed in 1873, and all property and investment were in dire danger. Labor was at the edge of starvation, and democracy and universal suffrage could function only through revolution. But a new savior appeared. Already, industry had been undergoing a process of integration, alliance, and imperial domination. Instead of lawless freebooters, there were appearing a few strong, purposeful kings with vast power of finance and technique in their hands. They promised law and order. They promised safe income on a sure property base with neither speculative bubbles nor criminal aggression. In other words, a new empire of industry was offering to displace capitalistic anarchy and form a dictatorship of capital to guide and repress universal suffrage. The conquest of the new industry in the ranks of labor was quick and certain. The growth of the National Labor Union into a labor party along Marxist lines, which had been developing from the close of the war, began to become petty bourgeois. It began to fight for capital and interest, and the right of the upper class of labor to share in the exploitation of common labor. The Negro, as a common laborer, belonged, therefore, not in, but beneath the white American labor movement. Craft and race unions spread. The better-paid, skilled, and intelligent American labor, formed itself into closed guilds and, in combination with capitalist guildmasters, extorted fair wages, which could be raised by negotiation. Foreign-born and Negro labor was left outside and tried several times, but in vain, to start a class-conscious labor movement. Skilled labor proceeded to share in the exploitation of the reservoir of low-paid common labor, and no strikes nor violence by overcrowded competing beggars for subsistence could move the industrial machine, so long as engineers and skilled labor kept it going. To be sure, the skilled labor guilds and capital had bitter disputes and even open fighting, but they fought to share profit from labor and not to eliminate profit. Big business with high-salaried engineers, well-paid skilled labor, and a mass of voiceless common labor then offered terms to the nation. Profiteering, graft, and theft had run wild in the North under the extreme individualism of post-war industry. Northern business had protected its monopoly by high tariff, profit from investments in railroad and government bonds, and new ventures. It had held its political power by the 14th Amendment and Reconstruction Acts. But its dominion and advance were threatened by loss of all moral standards, cutthroat competition. Political revolt threatened, which might result in lowering the tariff, attacking the banking and money system, and strengthening government control of business freedom. One way to forestall this was to effect inner control and coordination of business by centralizing the control of the power of capital, regaining the confidence of investors by sure and steady income, and driving from power the irregular banditti and highwaymen of industry. Fortunately for them, the Panic of 1873 checked the reform movement of 1872 and delivered the country into the power of the great financiers without seriously breaking the power of capital. Reform became liberal, attacking theft and graft and calling for freedom of the South from military control. Thus, the radical revolution of controlling capital and forcing recognition of the rights of labor by government control was lost sight of. Labor war ensued in the North, and serfdom was established in the South. But what of the South in this development? The planters had expected Negro governments to fall in confusion at the very beginning of the attempted dictatorship of labor. This did not happen. Writing in the American Historical Review, I said, in legislation covering property, the wider functions of the state, the punishment of crime and the like, it is sufficient to say that the laws on these points established by Reconstruction legislatures were not only different from and even revolutionary to the laws in the older South, but they were so wise and so well suited to the needs of the new South that in spite of a retrogressive movement following the overthrow of the Negro governments, the mass of this legislation, with elaboration and development, still stands on the statute books of the South. Reconstruction constitutions, practically unaltered, were kept in Florida, Virginia, South Carolina, Mississippi. Even in the case of states like Alabama, Georgia, North Carolina, and Louisiana, which adopted new constitutions to signify the overthrow of Negro rule, the new constitutions are nearer the model of the Reconstruction document than they are to the previous constitutions. They differ from the Negro constitutions in minor details, but very little in general conception. Besides this, there stands on the statute books of the South today law after law passed between 1868 and 1876, and which has been found wise, effective, and worthy of preservation. This compels us to begin with the fact that the basic difficulty with the South after the war was poverty, a depth of grinding poverty not easily conceivable even in these days of depression. In the first place, it goes without saying that the emancipated slave was poor. He was desperately poor, and poor in a way that we do not easily grasp today. He was and always had been without money, and except for his work in the Union Army, had no way of getting hold of cash. He could ordinarily get no labor contract that involved regular or certain payments of cash. He was without clothes and without a home. He had no way to rent or build a home. Food had to be begged or stolen, unless in some way he could get hold of land or go to work. And hired labor would, if he did not exercise the greatest care and get honest advice, result in something that was practically slavery. These conditions, of course, while true for the mass of freedmen, did not apply to workers in the army, artisans, or laborers in cities and others who had exceptional chances to obtain work for cash at something like decent rates. The white worker, in the mass, was equally poverty-stricken, except that he did usually hold, as a squatter, some land, and emancipation gave him better chance to hire his labor in cities. Finally, there were the impoverished planters, merchants and professional men who came out of the war with greatly reduced income and resources. In this setting of poverty, as nearly universal as one could have under modern conditions, must come the effort to set up a new state, and it is clear to the unprejudiced observer that no matter who had conducted that state, if there had been no Negro or other alien elements in the land, if there had been no universal suffrage, there would have been bitter dissatisfaction, widespread injustice, and vast transfer of wealth involving stealing and corruption. The freedman sought eagerly after the war, property, and income. He believed that his condition was not his own fault, but due to theft on a mighty scale. He demanded reimbursement and redress sufficient for a decent livelihood. This came partially from the federal government, from religious bodies, and in one lamentable case, the new industry reached forth a careless helping hand, expecting profit from the venture. No more extraordinary and disreputable venture ever disgraced American business, disguised as philanthropy, than the Freedmen's Bank, a chapter in American history which most Americans naturally prefer to forget. The organization of the Freedmen's Savings and Trust Company has been called one of the few sensible attempts made at the close of the Civil War to assist the ex-slave. During the Civil War, and when colored soldiers became numerous, the matter of their savings became of importance, and military savings banks were created at Norfolk, Virginia, and at Beaufort, South Carolina. At the same time, there were various sums of money held by the Departments of Negro Affairs in the different Army headquarters of the South. General Banks established a bank for Negroes in New Orleans in 1864, and General Butler and General Saxton in South Carolina established banks. Several efforts in 1865 were made to organize permanent savings banks. An Army paymaster, A.M. Sperry, hoped to absorb the banks at Norfolk, Virginia, and Beaufort, South Carolina. And in New Orleans, Negroes planned a labor bank. In January 1865, Alvord arranged a meeting of a number of interested persons and businessmen in New York, and the result was a bill to incorporate the Freedmen's Savings and Trust Company introduced into the Senate, February 13, 1865. Another bill was introduced into the House, and the name of Chief Justice Chase added as a trustee. These bills were combined and passed, and Lincoln signed the law, March 3rd. He said, "This bank is just what the freedmen need," at the same time that he signed the bill creating the Freedmen's Bureau. The incorporators and trustees of the bank included Peter Cooper, William Cullen Bryant, A.A. Lowe, Garrett Smith, John Jay, S.G. Howell, George L. Stearns, Edward Atkinson, and Chief Justice Chase. The business was confined to the Negro race, and at least two-thirds of the deposits must be invested in United States securities. For a while, the success of the Freedmen's Savings Bank was phenomenal, and the deposits extraordinarily encouraging. They came from day laborers, house servants, farmers, mechanics, and washerwomen, and the proverbial thriftlessness of the Negro seemed about to be disproven. North as well as South, the whites were agreeably surprised. Gradually, difficulties developed. On the one hand, in the North, the bank was regarded as a philanthropy and not worth the careful control and oversight of those who had loaned their names to it. The southern state governments began to oppose the branch banks because they were a sort of national system not under local control and took money away from local communities. The white banks were not disposed to cooperate and were often unfair, while the white planter regarded the Freedmen's Bank as part of the Freedmen's Bureau and did everything possible to embarrass it and curtail its growth. Before 1871, there had been errors in the conduct of the bank and disregard of law. Indeed, it is not quite clear whether in the original charter the bank had any right to establish branches outside the District of Columbia. Soon the speculators of Washington were attracted by the assets of the bank and discovered how they were growing. These assets were, however, amply protected by provisions requiring investment mainly in government bonds. An amendment to the charter was introduced into Congress in 1870, which provided that one half of the deposits invested in United States bonds might be invested in other notes and bonds secured by real estate mortgages. Immediately, the pennies of poor black laborers were replaced by worthless notes. Money was loaned recklessly to the speculators in the District of Columbia. Jay Cook and Company, the great bankers, borrowed $500,000, and this company and the First National Bank of Washington controlled the Freedmen's Bank between 1870 and 1873. Runs were started on the bank, and then an effort was made to unload the whole thing on Frederick Douglass as a representative Negro. This was useless, and the bank finally closed in June 1874. The Commission of Three, which liquidated the Freedmen's Savings Bank, paid depositors 30% and charged for their services $318,753. At the date of closing, so far as is known, there was due to depositors $2,993,790.68 in 61,144 accounts. This was never paid. The assets amounted to $32,089.35. The rest was represented by personal loans and loans on real estate, which were practically uncollectible. The total business transacted by the Freedmen's Bank was extraordinary, considering that the bulk of its clientele had just emerged from slavery. Its total deposits at one time reached $57 million. Thus, the most promising effort to raise the financial status of the best and thriftiest of Negroes went down in the maelstrom of national corruption. It is difficult to overestimate the psychological effect of this failure upon Negro thrift. But after all, the amount of cash handled by the freedmen was small, and by far the most pressing of his problems as a worker was that of land. This land hunger, this absolutely fundamental and essential thing to any real emancipation of the slaves, was continually pushed by all emancipated Negroes and their representatives in every Southern state. It was met by ridicule, by anger, and by dishonest and insincere efforts to satisfy it, apparently. The Freedmen's Bureau had much Confederate property in its possession, but the seizure of abandoned estates in the South came as a measure to stop war, and not as a plan for economic rebirth. Just as the slaves were enticed from the South in order to stop the aid which they could give to rebels, in the same way, the land of masters who ran away or were absent, aiding the rebellion, was seized. And this large body of land was the nucleus of the proposal to furnish 40 acres to each emancipated slave. The scheme was further advanced when Sherman, embarrassed by the number of Negroes who followed him from Atlanta to the sea, and gathered around him in Savannah and South Carolina, as a war measure settled them upon the abandoned sea islands and the adjacent coast. Confiscated property was in some cases condemned, or sold on order of the federal courts for unpaid taxes, and the title vested in the United States. Thus, the Freedmen's Bureau came into possession of nearly 800,000 acres of farmland, with control over it, except the right of sale. This land was in Virginia, Georgia, South Carolina, Louisiana, North Carolina, Kentucky, and Tennessee. There was very little in Alabama and Florida, and none in Texas. The Bureau intended to divide up this land and allot it to the freedmen and the white refugees, but much of it was tied up with leases, and, after all, despite the large amount, there was never enough to give the freedmen alone an acre apiece. 1,000,000 acres among 1,000,000 farmers meant nothing, and from the beginning there was need of from 25 to 50 million acres more if the Negroes were to be installed as peasant farmers. Against any plan of this sort was the settled determination of the planter South to keep the bulk of Negroes as landless laborers and the deep repugnance on the part of Northerners to confiscating individual property. Even Thaddeus Stevens was not able to budge the majority of Northerners from this attitude. Added to this was the disinclination of the United States to add to its huge debt by undertaking any large and costly social adjustments after the war. To give land to free citizens smacked of paternalism, It came directly in opposition to the American assumption that any American could be rich if he wanted to, or at least well-to-do, and it stubbornly ignored the exceptional position of a freed slave. Indeed, it is a singular commentary on the attitude of the government to remember that the Freedmen's Bureau itself, during the first year, was financed not by taxation, but by the toil of ex-slaves. The total amount of rents collected from lands in the hands of the Bureau, paid mostly by Negroes, amounted to $400,000, and curiously enough, it was this rent that supported the Freedmen's Bureau during the first year. Surprise and ridicule has often been voiced concerning this demand of Negroes for land. It has been regarded primarily as a method of punishing rebellion. Motives of this sort may have been in the minds of some northern whites, but so far as the Negroes were concerned, their demand for a reasonable part of the land on which they had worked for a quarter of a millennium was absolutely justified, and to give them anything less than this was an economic farce. On the other hand, to have given each one of the million Negro free families a 40-acre freehold would have made a basis of real democracy in the United States that might easily have transformed the modern world. The law of June 21, 1860, opened public land in Alabama, Mississippi, Missouri, Arkansas, and Florida, but comparatively few of the freedmen could take advantage of this offer. The Bureau gave some assistance in transporting families, but most of the Negroes had neither stock nor farm implements, and the whites in those localities bitterly opposed their settling. Only about 4,000 families out of nearly 4 million people acquired homes under this act. The Sherman Order gave rise to all sorts of difficulties. The Negroes were given only possessory titles. Then the owners came back, and immediately there was trouble. The Negroes protested, "What is the use of giving us freedom if we can't stay where we were raised and own our own house where we were born and our own piece of ground?" It was on May 25, 1865, that Johnson, in his proclamation of pardon, had provided easy means whereby all property could be restored, except the land at Port Royal, which had been sold for taxes. General Howard came to Charleston to make arrangements, and the story is characteristic. "At first," said a witness, "the people hesitated, but soon as the meaning struck them that they must give up their little homes and gardens and work for others, there was a general murmuring of dissatisfaction." General Howard was called upon to address them, and to cover his own confusion and sympathy, he asked them to sing. Immediately, an old woman on the outskirts of the meeting began, "Nobody knows the trouble I've seen." Howard wept. The colored landholders drew up an illiterate petition to Andrew Johnson, the poor white expressing sad feelings over his decree and begging for an acre and a half of land each. But naturally, nothing came of it. For President Johnson, forgetting his own pre-war declaration that the great plantations must be seized and divided into small farms, declared that this land must be restored to its original owners, and this would be done if owners received a presidential pardon. The pardoning power was pushed, and the land all over the South rapidly restored. Negroes were dispossessed, the revenue of the Bureau reduced. Many schools had to be discontinued. The Bureau became no longer self-supporting, and its whole policy was changed. In December 1865, the Bureau had 768,590 acres of land. In 1868, there were only 139,644 acres left, and much of this unimproved and unfertile. For a long time, there still persisted the idea that the government was going to make a distribution of land. The rumor was that this was to be made January 1, 1865, and for months before that, Negroes all over the South declined to make contracts for work and were accordingly accused of laziness and insubordination. The restoration of the lands not only deprived Negroes in various ways of a clear path toward livelihood, but greatly discouraged them and broke their faith in the United States government. These disappointments and discouragements did not for a moment stop the individual efforts of exceptional and lucky Negroes to get hold of land, and the cheapness of the land enabled them to make purchases on a considerable scale where they could get hold of a money wage. The land holdings of Negroes increased all over the South. In South Carolina, the gradual subdivision of the land showed that poor people, colored and white, were slowly getting hold of the divided plantations. Some 33,000 plantations were divided among 93,000 small farmers. Virginia Negroes acquired between 80,000 and 100,000 acres of land during the late 60s and early 70s. There were soon a few prosperous Negro farmers with 400 to 1,000 acres of land and some owners of considerable city property. Georgia Negroes had bought, by 1875, 396,658 acres of land, assessed at $1,263,902, and added to this, they had town and city property assessed at $1,203,202. Of Arkansas in 1875, Nordoff said, "Of the 40,000 Negro voters in the state, it is believed that at least 1 in 20 owns either a farm or a house and lot in town." This would give but 2,000 such independent landholders, a small number, but yet a beginning, showing that even amidst the intense and incessant political turmoil of the last 7 years, a part of the colored men have been persistently industrious and economical. All this was the record of the exceptional and lucky freedmen. After all, they owned in 1870 less than one-tenth of the land which they ought to have possessed, and the wages of nine-tenths of the black laborers were low and seldom paid in cash or with regularity. Wesley gives figures showing annual wages in southern states to have ranged from $89 to $150 in 1867 and 1868. On the other hand, this demand for land by government action and the increased disposition to vote public funds for the benefit of the pauperized masses incensed the planters. In every southern state, the South from 1868 to 1876 stressed more and more the anomaly of letting people who had no property vote away the wealth of the rich. The strongest statement of the case against the black legislature of South Carolina was that they paid almost no taxes upon property. They who, for the most part, had only had the right to hold property since 1866. This charge against the poor, frequent as it always is in democratic movements, is not valid. The first attempt of a democracy, which includes the previously disfranchised poor, is to redistribute wealth and income, and this is exactly what the Black South attempted. The theory is that the wealth and the current income of the wealthy ruling class does not belong to them entirely, but is the product of the work and striving of the great millions, and that, therefore, these millions ought to have a voice in its more equitable distribution. And if this is true in modern countries like France and England and Germany, how much more true was it in the South after the war, where the poorest class represented the most extreme case of theft of labor that the world can conceive, namely chattel slavery? On the other hand, there is not the slightest doubt but that the South had a right to demand of the nation that the whole of the burden of this readjustment of wealth should not fall upon the planters. Guilty as they were of supreme exploitation of labor, their guilt was shared by the rest of the nation, just as the rest of the nation had for centuries shared the profits of the slave system. It would have been fair and just for the cost of emancipating the slaves and giving them land to be equitably shared by the whole of the United States. Moreover, the increased taxation of which the South so bitterly complained was not wholly for social uplift. It took mainly the form of 1. Restoration of injured property. 2. Restoration of capital investment, lost or injured, as in the case of the railroads. 3. The expense of a new system of public education. 4. The expense of carrying on a government with enlarged functions. Only the last two directly benefited the black worker. There had been a destruction and disappearance of invested capital through war and emancipation, which represented the greater part of the whole invested capital of the South except land. The value of the land decreased enormously because of the disappearance of slave labor and the destruction of a whole industrial system. Accurate figures are out of the question. A report to the House of Representatives, 42nd Congress, gives these estimates. The total assessed property of the South in 1860, including slaves, was $4,363,030,347.05. In 1870, it was $141,834,188.02, a loss of $1,634,105,341 in slaves, and $586,990,218 in other property. The total loss in the South by the war, in property, assets, and debts, state and Confederate, has been estimated at $5,262,303,554.26. These were the losses of capital. But what of the losses of 9 million laborers, represented not so much by positive loss as by negative deprivation and exploitation for centuries? The 19th century assumed that universal suffrage would prevent the state from falling into the power of forces inimical to the masses. It might and did leave power in the hands of property and invested capital, but it left them less chance to oppress unduly the laboring class, insofar as that class was thrifty and intelligent. But suppose labor was not intelligent and had been so long enslaved that shiftlessness became a virtue. It seemed clear that in America and in all leading countries in the latter half of the 19th century, the dictatorship of wealth and capital would be modified in some degree by reference to the will of the mass of laborers. In this way, industrial peace and progress toward high standards of living for the masses would be secured without disturbing the bases of capitalistic production. Thus, the guidance and dictatorship of capital for the object of private profit were not to be questioned or overthrown, but it must maintain that ascendancy by controlling the public opinion of the laboring class. This was accomplished, and, on the whole, easily accomplished, by the power to give and withhold employment from people who were without capital, the power to fix wages within certain wide limits, the power to influence public opinion through the prestige of wealth, news, and literature, and the power to dominate legislatures, courts, and offices of administration. The building and buttressing of the new and more powerful capitalistic imperialism was slow and difficult, and with purposeful leadership, labor could enormously curtail the power of capital and bring nearer a critical time when the dictatorship of capital must yield to a dictatorship of labor, when general well-being would replace individual profit as the object of industry. This was not so clear in detail in the middle of the 19th century as it is now. There were Democrats like Sumner and Stevens who sensed the new power which supercapital was beginning to assert over labor, and particularly over universal suffrage. Still, it seemed to them that the right to vote in the hands of the intelligent mass could dictate the form of any state that it wished. The difficulty was that the mass of labor, and particularly black labor, was not intelligent. They freely admitted, therefore, that while it would be better to give the right of suffrage only to those Negroes who were intelligent, and particularly those who by economic opportunity would amass some little capital, nevertheless they felt that since the South compelled them to choose between universal suffrage and disfranchised landless labor in the control of landholders and capitalists, with increased political power based on the disfranchisement of labor, the right of suffrage even in the hands of the poor and ignorant gave better chance for ultimate economic justice than their disfranchisement. It was for this reason that they advocated universal suffrage for the emancipated slaves. They were offered no middle ground. There were in the South only spasmodic signs that any powerful body of public opinion was willing to admit the Negro to the right of suffrage, no matter how intelligent he became, or to admit white labor without nullifying its vote by giving to capital the power based on disfranchised blacks. Yet without some acceptance of a labor vote, the modern state could not endure. And while the cost of introducing this sudden change in the South was great, yet the action of the dominant South left no alternative. It was either universal suffrage or modified slavery, and in either case, increased political power in the nation for the former slave oligarchy. Moreover, it is certain that unless the right to vote had been given the Negro by federal law in 1867, he would never have got it in America. There never has been a time since when race propaganda in America offered the slightest chance for colored people to receive American citizenship. There would have been, therefore, perpetuated in the South and in America a permanently disfranchised mass of laborers, and the dictatorship of capital would, under those circumstances, have been even more firmly implanted than it is today. Certainly and naturally, the slaves were far more ignorant and poverty-stricken than the mass of northern white laborers. A dictatorship of federal power was therefore set up in the first Freedmen's Bureau bill, which would have furnished them land and schools and protected their civil and economic rights until they were ready for universal suffrage or had learned by using it. The bill, as finally passed, left out the provision for land and most of the provisions for education. The Negroes themselves continued to demand land when they were enfranchised by the Reconstruction Bill of 1867, but this evoked shrieks of anger from property in the South and apprehension from property in the North. There arose in the South an extraordinary situation which few scholars have studied in its economic aspects. First, there was black labor, in the main ignorant and poor, but with some leaders of intelligence, backed in part by the military power of the North. Secondly, there was white exploitation, which in the South had been based on the ownership of land and labor, and which was now widely impoverished, but still left with most of the land, some capital, and large social influence. There was, in addition to these, the mass of impoverished and ignorant white peasants and laborers. To this, there were added a number of northern immigrants, with smaller or larger amounts of capital. It is idle to speculate as to just how this situation could have been avoided. Of course, it would not have arisen if slavery had continued. Moreover, there would have been less evident catastrophe and turmoil immediately if slavery had been continued under another name, in accordance with the efforts of the Southern states under the Johnson Reconstruction Plan. But this simply meant a postponement of the trouble. Eventually, the complete agrarian capitalistic system, based on the ownership of both land and labor, had to disappear from America and the world, and its disappearance had to spell revolution, involving a vast transfer of capital and of political power. This revolution might have taken the form of annulling property in slaves, with indemnity to the slave owners, and seeking to put into the South a laboring class without political power. This would have been an impossible solution because this laboring class would have been thrown into even more direct competition with white laborers the land over, a fact which had already been a cause of civil war. And it would have involved an attempt at capitalistic autocracy without the corrective of universal suffrage among a third of the American laboring class. Moreover, the capital to indemnify the slave owners must have come out of the wealth of that part of the country whose capital was being taxed to pay the staggering cost of a war to overthrow political power based on enslaved labor. Northern capital would not consent to restore Southern loss from investment in slaves, much less if this restored capital were to be used to compete with capital in the North. There ensued in the South a contest for the ultimate dictatorship of the state in conjunction with universal suffrage for black and white. The temporary dictatorship set up by the federal government represented and had to represent, in essence, the attitude of northern capitalists. The parties that hoped to dominate this dictatorship, all of them, lacked capital. The planter had been impoverished by the war. The small capitalist from the north who had come south brought little to invest, but expected to accumulate capital on the spot. And the poor white represented the impoverished peasantry and labor class, as well as a petty bourgeois of small merchants and professional men. Here, then, was the situation. And what had to follow? The planters had to move toward the control of the political power of newly enfranchised labor, both black and white. One can see such movements in the consent of Beauregard and Longstreet in Louisiana, Alcorn in Mississippi, and Hampton in South Carolina, to Negro suffrage, and their willingness to concede something of economic power to the black voters. But this movement, which would have been comparatively simple under the ordinary organization of capital and labor in modern countries, was complicated by three facts. First, there came in a new, eager class of competing capitalists who proposed to share with the planters the dictatorship of labor. Secondly, the movement of the planter class to attract black labor with economic concession met the immediate and bitter fear and opposition of the poor whites, not simply of the mass of half-starved white peasants and farmers, but of the merchants, the former slave overseers, and managers, men who proposed to join the planters as exploiters of labor. These desperately feared the rise of black labor to a position which might equal and even surpass the poor whites. This was shown in the voting in Alabama under Johnson's Reconstruction, where the poor white counties went solidly against the black belt on several occasions, and it was also shown in the bitter opposition to the counting of black folk as a basis of representation. If the whole population was to be counted as a basis of representation, then after the war, as before, the black belt and its capitalistic dictators were going to dominate white labor, and it was for this reason that the poor whites long fought to exclude the Negro in apportioning the political power of the state, and after Reconstruction, united in disfranchising him. When the Negro received the right to vote and had to be counted, there arose a desperate effort on the part of the poor whites to keep the planters from controlling the Negro vote by their economic power. Sometimes this effort took the crude method of driving black labor off the plantations and intimidating it in various ways. Sometimes it took the form of trying to lead black labor through demagogues, like Hunnicutt in Virginia. And all the time in the background was the feeling that unless the planters united with the poor whites in a solid racial phalanx against the black voters, anarchy and destruction were preferable to the economic rise of the Negro. How this interaction of former land monopolists, white peasant and Negro peasant, would have worked itself out if uncomplicated by other interests is a question, but it seems almost inevitable that division would have had to take place along economic rather than racial lines, and that the planter capitalists, reinforcing themselves with recruits from a poor white petty bourgeois, would have organized to control white and black labor endowed with universal suffrage along the same lines that allowed capital in the North to control native white labor and new immigrants. There entered, however, the small northern investor, usually and inaccurately comprehended under the term carpetbagger, a phrase too vague for our use, but too much used to discard. When the war ended, there were large numbers of northern soldiers and officers in the South. There were civilian agents of the government, and there were other Northerners who looked toward the South as a place of economic rebirth and investment. There was nothing extraordinary in this. Thousands upon thousands of Southerners had come into the North and had been welcomed to its freedom and opportunities. While this migration to the South had come mainly in time of war, with the resultant war hatred and bitterness, still its main reason was economic. Men with smaller and larger amounts of capital, and many with no capital, proposed to invest in land and free labor in the South at a time when the great staples of Southern agriculture were abnormally high and in wide demand throughout the world. These men, so far as they were investing capitalists, and most of them were, proposed to build up in the South the same kind of capitalistic democracy based on universal suffrage to which they had been used in the North. They were going to trade with free black labor and white labor and yield to it that amount of consideration and that economic share of the product which they would naturally have to yield in order to keep their dictatorship and yet get profit for themselves. If, now, the new northern capitalists and the southern planter class had been united into one new capitalistic class, their only problem would have been to deal with a new laboring class composed of blacks and whites, and to admit to their ranks those of either class who had or could get any amount of new capital. But both capitalists and laborers were split in two. There was hatred and jealousy in the ranks of this new prospective capitalistic class, and race prejudice and fear in the ranks of the laborers. In the new capitalistic class, the hatred of the planters for Northerners, who apparently were planning to add to the conquests of war new conquests of economic power, was naturally intense. It was this same power of Northern capital which, in Southern minds, caused civil war. The new Northern capitalists, on the other hand, could not understand why they should not be welcomed as investors without sentiment in a region where investment of new capital was sadly needed, and why this should not be accompanied by the same attitude toward labor which capital must take throughout the world if it were going to maintain its mastery. Thirdly, the poor whites began a desperate and almost panic-stricken attempt to force themselves into this situation, either as allies of the old planter class, which had for them the greatest contempt, or as allies of the carpetbagger capitalist, against whom they had just been fighting in the ranks of the army, and whose attitude toward black labor they did not understand and feared, or even as allies of black labor, which they might use as a club against both planter and capitalist. The ensuing turmoil in the South was a fight of these three pretenders to economic power over the capitalistic state, and also it was further complicated by the fact that the federal military dictatorship was in the hands of Northern capitalists and Northern social workers. There ensued a fierce fight for mastery, characterized by widespread graft, corruption, and violence. For what responsibility did any of these parties have to a state they did not own? And the greater the failure of government through any of the contenders, the more it justified radical change. When the planter class moved toward black labor, its leaders made demands which the planters would not meet, namely, demands for land, education, and the expense of social uplift. These demands of the black laborer might have been modified if he had not found that they were easily promised and partially fulfilled by the carpetbag capitalist. He, therefore, turned to the carpetbagger for leadership, and through him was given education and at least a possibility of buying land. The poor white could try to compete with the carpetbag capitalist in leadership and demagoguery over the Negroes, or he could seek alliance with the planter because the planter's property was bearing the main cost of the new educational social program. Or, by sabotage, he could seek to sink the government in anarchy. Small wonder that the ensuing graft, stealing, and renewal of civil war was widely misunderstood. But the very last place where the blame for the situation could, by the wildest imagination, be placed was upon the newly enfranchised black labor. What the Negro needed and what he desperately sought was leadership in knowledge and industry. In knowledge, he wanted through his own irrepressible demand for education to become an intelligent citizen, and a start toward this he received through the splendid and unselfish cooperation of the Northern social workers connected with the federal dictatorship and through their allies, the teachers who came down to man the Freedmen's Bureau schools. By straining his political power to the utmost, the Negro voter got a public school system, and got it because that was one clear object which he understood, and which no bribery or chicanery could seduce him from advocating and insisting upon, in season and out. On the other hand, in economic leadership, in the whole question of work and wage, he was almost entirely at sea. His higher schools, based on New England capitalism and individualism, gave little training for an economic battle, just dawning in the world, and far from the conception of leaders in Southern industry. Even his later industrial schools were tied hand and foot to triumphant capitalism, unhampered by a labor vote. He had, then, but one clear economic ideal, and that was his demand for land, his demand that the great plantations be subdivided and given to him as his right. This was a perfectly fair and natural demand, and ought to have been an integral part of emancipation. To emancipate 4 million laborers whose labor had been owned, and separate them from the land upon which they had worked for nearly 2.5 centuries, was an operation such as no modern country had for a moment attempted or contemplated. The German and English and French serf, the Italian and Russian serf, were, on emancipation, given definite rights in the land. Only the American Negro slave was emancipated without such rights, and in the end, this spelled for him the continuation of slavery. Beyond this demand for land, economic leadership for the Negro failed. He appealed to his former master. The best of the planters, those who in slavery days had occupied a patriarchal position toward their slaves, were besieged not only by their own former slaves, but by others for advice and leadership. If they had wished, they could have held the Negro vote in the palm of their hands. The Negroes would have followed him implicitly, and it was this that poor whites, from Andrew Johnson down, feared. But they forgot that the planters were estopped from this program by their own lack of capital. By the new and confiscatory taxation which the Negroes' demands entailed, even under the most frugal and honest administration, by their own singular lack of knowledge of the methods of capitalistic democracy throughout the world, which was based on those very concessions to labor of which they could not conceive. They kept insisting on hard, regular toil, vague and irregular wages, and no exercise of political power. All this in a day when labor the world over demanded shorter hours, a definite high-wage contract, and the right to vote. To this attitude of the planters must be added the bitter jealousy, not only of the worst and more vicious and selfish of the planters, but of the poor whites. And when there was added to this the fact that they themselves were being supplanted as advisors of Negroes by the new white northern capitalist, willing to grant labor's demands at the expense of the state, they, in most cases, utterly refused to lead Negro labor, and thus threw the Negroes back on the carpetbag capitalists for advice and leadership. Thither, too, Negroes were attracted by a trust that naturally grew out of the fact that these people represented their emancipation. They represented Abraham Lincoln and his government, and Negroes were naturally strongly inclined to do anything that this leadership told them to, even when the advice was dishonest and unwise. Thus were the freedmen landed in piteous contradiction and difficulty. The Negroes' own black leadership was naturally of many sorts. Some, like the whites, were petty bourgeois, seeking to climb to wealth. Others were educated men, helping to develop a new nation without regard to mere race lines, while a third group were idealists, trying to uplift the Negro race and put them on a par with the whites. But how was this to be accomplished? In the minds of very few of them, was there any clear and distinct plan for the development of a laboring class into a position of power and mastery over the modern industrial state? And in this lack of vision, they were not singular in America. Where else in the land, even among labor leaders, was there any such fixed and definite program of action? The fight for the domination of the new form of state which Reconstruction was building took the direction of using the income for new forms of state expenses, and for that, public investment for private profit was the widespread custom in the North. The South had entered only to a small extent into such schemes and tended to regard them as outside the function of the state. Even the forms of expenditure for education and the help of indigents were kinds of expenditure to which the Southern taxpayers had not been used and in which, for the most part, they did not believe. There were consequently fierce outcries against the waste of such expenditures. When, in addition to that, there came widespread and deliberate investment of public funds in railroads and corporations, where the profits went to speculators and grafters, the protest of landed property was intensified. The results of this form of stealing bore hard upon the impoverished landholder and were particularly detestable to him because, monopolizing the government before the war, he had largely escaped taxation and had tried to transfer it to the shoulders of the small businessman. Now the small businessman, reinforced by the carpetbagger and black voter, was returning it to the landholder. Assessments were increased, and the gradual disestablishment of the landed aristocracy became imminent. Here is the crux of the matter. It was this large and, for the day and circumstances, overwhelming loss that lay at the bottom of the extraordinary charges of extravagance and stealing that characterized the Reconstruction controversy. For had there been no further loss, and no necessity nor effort to increase the customary taxation of the past, the planter would have felt hurt to his heart by the disappearance of the bulk of his capital. But when to this was added a new taxation for uplifting Negroes and enriching Northerners, he raised his protest to a shriek of bitterness. When we try to get to the details of the Southern states' debts after the war, and during Reconstruction, we are faced by the fact that there is no agreement among authorities. The reasons for this are several. First, what is a debt? Is it the amount which a state actually owes, or is it the amount for which a state may become liable in the future, by reason of present commitments and promises? In this latter case, for how much does it actually become liable? A careful examination of such facts, as seem established, shows that the increase of debts under the Reconstruction regime was not large. In 11 Southern states, there was little over $100 million of debt in 1860, which rose to $222 million on account of war. When the Confederate debt was repudiated, the recognized debts in 1865 stood at $156 million. To this should be added certain railroad liabilities of Alabama, which brings the total debt at the beginning of Reconstruction to $175 million. In 1871, this debt had increased nearly 100% to $305 million. But $100 million of this debt consisted in contingent and prospective liabilities due to the issue of railway bonds, which confuses the whole issue with regard to Reconstruction debts. The whole increase of debt during 1860 to 1871 amounted apparently to less than 100%. What now did this increase of debt due to the railway bonds mean? It meant that Southern and Northern men, Republicans and Democrats, had united to put the credit of the state back of their railway investments. The only way in which 9/10 of Negro voters came into this matter was as their representatives were bribed by both parties to support this legislation for private profit. Such bribery undoubtedly was widespread, but it was widespread not only among Negro voters, but among white voters, and among all the voters of the United States, and among members of all legislatures and members of Congress. It could hardly be argued that in this respect, new and largely ignorant Negro voters should show a higher public morality than the rest of the country. On the other hand, the wrath of the landholders against this increase in debt was the wrath of agrarian capitalists against the new industrialism, and yet they were unable to prosecute those who stole the state's money through the issue of railway bonds because there were too many Southern people and Southern people of prominence involved. This was shown in North Carolina, where despite the extravagant investment in railways, the hope of white immigration and rapid development was disappointed, and the landholders put the commercialists out of power, but they did not dare prosecute them. In Mississippi, on the other hand, where the Negro was as powerful as in any state, there was no increase of debt, because from the first, the landholders and Negroes refused to loan the credit of the state to railroads. If the money raised by taxes had been spent carefully and honestly upon legitimate and necessary matters of restoration and government, the increase is not unreasonable. Or, in other words, there is nothing on the face of the figures that proves unusual theft. Over 150 millions of this debt was repudiated by the reactionary governments which came into office after 1876. John F. Hume claims that to this should be added $120 million of debts repudiated before the Civil War, showing that the South was not unused to dealing in this way with borrowed funds. This indebtedness must also be interpreted by considering the price of gold. South Carolina's debt of $22 million in 1871 was made when paper money was at 70 and was therefore equivalent to $15.5 million in 1860. Indeed, the curve of the price of gold explains to some extent the curve of alleged extravagance. The debt of these states between the time when it reached its highest point in 1880 was scaled down to $108,003,974. This meant that a sum of $155,525,856 was repudiated, and it will be noted that this is almost exactly the increased indebtedness which the Reconstruction regime incurred in order to meet the increased burden of the state. Public school education, charitable institutions, the restoration of public buildings, and increased social responsibilities. There can be no possible proof that all of this increased indebtedness represented theft, nor is there any adequate reason for believing that most of it did. What happened in Southern repudiation after the war was that the Southern states proceeded to punish people who had dared to loan money to the Southern states under Negro suffrage by confiscating the sums which they had loaned. This was what they had threatened to do, and they did it with vengeance. There are certain other considerations. White Southerners were in practically complete control during the Reconstruction regime in Virginia and Tennessee. Yet in these two states, an indebtedness of $52 million in 1860 increased to $88 million before 1880, and $34 million of this was repudiated. This could hardly be charged to Negro suffrage. Then, too, in North Carolina, Georgia, and Alabama, the ex-Confederate South never lost all control and was early restored to full control. Yet, in these states, an indebtedness of $19 million in 1860 reached $81 million before 1880, and of this, $56 million was repudiated. A part of the blame of this may be shouldered on white Northerners, but very little of it could possibly be attributed to Negroes. In the case of Florida and Mississippi, the debt was negligible and, on the face of it, absolutely defensible. Yet large amounts were repudiated by the Reform Party. In South Carolina, the debt stood at nearly $6 million in 1865 before Reconstruction. It reached at its highest point before 1880, nearly $25 million, and of this, $17 million was repudiated. If any large proportion of it represented theft, it represented as much the illegal graft of northern moneylenders as the theft of money actually received by the state. Arkansas, under a government in which the Negro had almost no part, repudiated $12 million out of $18 million of indebtedness. The whole debt transaction of the South after Reconstruction seemed to show that many of the accusations of unreasonable debt and the haste at repudiation were a blow aimed at northern finance rather than a proof of Negro extravagance. It was openly said in Louisiana that it was fitting that the northerners who tore down the bases of our former prosperity should share some of the ills.